I needed to go down to the police station, but I didn't have a car. I had a few dollars in my pocket, nothing in my checking account. My credit cards were in collection. I had to make another apprehension. I called Connie and told her about Morty Byers.
"This is going to make a serious hole in Vinny's dike," Connie said. "Range is recovering from gunshot, and now Morty Byers is out of the picture. They were our two best agents."
"Yeah, that sure is a shame. I guess Vinny's left with me." There was a pause at the other end of the phone.
"You didn't do Morty, did you?"
"Morty sort of did himself. You have anything easy come in? I could use some fast money."
"I have an exhibitionist gone FTA on a $2,000 bond. He's been kicked out of 3 retirement homes. He's currently living in an apartment somewhere."
I could hear her shuffling through papers.
"Here it is," she said.
"Oh, my God, he's living in your building."
"What's his name?"
"William Erling. He's in apartment 3E. I grabbed my pocketbook and locked up. I took the stairs to the 3rd floor, counted off apartments, and knocked on Erling's door. A man answered, and right off I suspected I had the right person because he was old and he was naked.
"Mr. Erling?"
"Yep, that's me. I'm in pretty good shape, huh, Chickie? You think I've got some fearful equipment?"
I gave myself a mental command not to look, but my eyes strayed south of their own volition. Not only wasn't he fearful, but his doodles were wrinkled.
"Yeah, you're pretty fearful," I said.
I handed him my card. "I work for Vincent Plum, your bond agent. You failed to appear for a court hearing, Mr. Erling. I need to take you downtown so you can reschedule."
"Damn, court hearings are a waste of time," Erling said. "I'm 76 years old. You think they're gonna send some 76-year-old guy to prison because he flashed his stuff around?"
I sincerely hoped so. Seeing Erling naked was enough to make me turn celibate. "I need to take you downtown. How about you go put some clothes on?"
"I don't wear clothes. God brought me into the world naked, and that's the way I'm going out."
"Okay by me. But in the meantime, I wish you'd get dressed."
"The only way I'm going with you is naked."
I took out my cuffs and snapped them on his wrists.
"Police brutality! Police brutality!" he yelled.
"Sorry to disappoint you," I said. "I'm not a cop."
"Well, what are you?"
"I'm a bounty hunter."
"Bounty hunter brutality! Bounty hunter brutality!"
I went to the hall closet, found a full-length raincoat, and buttoned him into it.
"I'm not going with you,"
he said, standing rigid, his hands cuffed under the coat.
"You can't make me go."
"Listen, Grandpa," I said. "Either you go peaceably, or I'll gas you and drag you out by your heels." I couldn't believe I was saying this to some poor senior citizen with a snail dick. I was appalled at myself. But what the hell? It was worth $200.
"Don't forget the lockup," he said. "This neighborhood's going to heck in a handbasket. The keys are in the kitchen."
I got the keys, and one of them had a little Buick insignia on it.
What a break.
"One more thing," I said. "Would you mind if I borrowed your car to take you downtown?"
"I guess that'd be okay as long as we don't use too much gas. I'm on a fixed income, you know."
I buzzed Mr. Erling through in record time and took care not to run into Dorsey. I stopped at the office on the way home to pick up my check and stopped at the bank to cash it. I parked Mr. Erling's car as close to the door as possible to cut down on his streaking distance when he got out of jail. I didn't want to see any more of Mr. Erling than was absolutely unavoidable. I jogged upstairs and called home,
cringing at the thought of what I was about to do.
"Is Daddy out with the cab?" I asked. "I need a ride."
"He's off today. He's right here. Where do you need to go?"
"An apartment complex on Route 1. Another cringe.
"Now?"
"Yeah." Very large sigh. "Now."
"I'm having stuffed shells tonight. Would you like some stuffed shells?"
Hard to believe how much I wanted those stuffed shells. More than good sex, a fast car, a cool night, or eyebrows. I wanted temporary respite from adulthood. I wanted to feel unconditionally safe. I wanted my mom to cluck around me, filling my milk glass, relieving me of the most mundane responsibilities. I wanted to spend a few hours in a house cluttered with awful overstuffed furniture and oppressive cooking smells.
Stuffed shells would be good.
My father was at the back door in 15 minutes. He gave a start at the sight of me.
"We had an accident in the parking lot," I said. "A car caught fire and I was standing too close."
I gave him the address and asked him to stop at Kmart on the way. 30 minutes later, he dropped me off in Morelli's parking lot.
"Tell Mom I'll be there by 6, I told him.
He looked at the Nova and the case of motor oil I'd just purchased.
"Maybe I should stay to make sure it runs."
I fed the car 3 cans and checked the dipstick. I gave my father an A-OK sign. He didn't seem impressed. I got behind the wheel, gave the dash a hard shot with my fist, and cranked her over.
"Starts every time!" I yelled.
My father was still impassive, and I knew he was thinking, "I should have bought a Buick." These indignities never befell Buicks. We pulled out of the lot together, and I waved him off on Route 1, pointing the Nova in the direction of Ye Old Muffler Shop. Past the orange-peaked roof of the Howard Johnson Motel, past the Shady Grove Trailer Park, past Happy Days Kennels. Other drivers were giving me a wide berth, not daring to enter into my thundering wake. 7 miles down the road, I cheered at the sight of the yellow and black muffler shop sign. I wore my Oakleys to hide my eyebrows, but the counterman still did a double take. I filled out the forms and gave him the keys and took a seat in the small room reserved for the parents of sick cars. 45 minutes later, I was on my way. I only noticed the smoke when I stopped at an intersection, and the red light only blinked on occasionally. I figured that was as good as I could expect. My mother started as soon as I hit the front porch.
"Every time I see you, you look worse and worse. Bruises and cuts, and now what happened to your hair? And oh my God, you haven't got eyebrows. What happened to your eyebrows? Your father said you were in a fire."
"A car caught fire in my parking lot. It wasn't anything."
"I saw it on TV," Grandma Mazur said, elbowing her way past my mother. "They said it was a bombing. Blew the car sky high. And some guy was in the car, some sleazoid named Baez, except there wasn't much left of him."
Grandma Mazur was wearing a pink and orange print cotton blouse with the tissue wadded up in the sleeve, bright blue spandex shorts, white tennies, and stockings rolled just above her knees.
"I like your shorts," I said to her.
"Great color."
"She went like that to the funeral home this afternoon," my father yelled from the kitchen. "Tony Mancuso's viewing."
"I tell you, it was something," Grandma Mazur said. "The VFW was there. Best viewing I've been to all month. And Tony looked real good. They gave him one of those ties with the little horse heads on."
"We got 7 phone calls so far," my mother said. "I told everyone she forgot to take a medicine this morning." Grandma Mazur clacked her teeth.
"Nobody knows fashion around here.
You can't hardly wear anything different.
She looked down at her shorts.
What do you think? She asked me. You think these are okay for an afternoon viewing?
Sure, I said. But if it was at night, I'd wear black.
Just exactly what I was thinking. I gotta get me some black ones next.
By 8 o'clock, I was sated with good food and overstuffed furniture and ready to once again take up the mantle of independent living. I staggered out of my parents' house, arms loaded with leftovers, and motored back to my apartment. For the better part of the day, I'd avoided thinking about the explosion. But it was time to face facts. Someone had tried to kill me, and it wasn't Ramirez. Ramirez wanted to inflict pain and hear me beg. Ramirez was frightening and abhorrent, but he was also predictable. I knew where Ramirez was coming from. Ramirez was criminally insane. Planting a bomb was a different kind of insanity. A bombing was calculated and purposeful. A bombing was meant to rid the world of a particular, annoying person. Why me? I thought. Why would someone want me dead? Even articulating the question sent a chill through my heart. I parked the Nova in the middle of my lot and wondered if I'd have the courage to step on the accelerator tomorrow morning. Morelli's car had been shoveled away, and there was little evidence of the fire. The macadam was pocked and cracked where the Jeep had burned, but there was no crime scene tape or charred debris to further mark the spot. I let myself into my apartment and found my answering machine light furiously blinking. Dorsey had called 3 times, requesting a call back. He didn't sound friendly. Bernie had called to say they were having a store-wide sale and I should drop by. 20% off blenders and a complimentary bottle of daiquiri mix to the first 20 customers. My eyes glazed over at the thought of a daiquiri. I still had a few dollars left, and blenders had to be pretty cheap in the overall scheme of things, right? The last call was from Jimmy Alpha, with another apology and his hopes that I hadn't been badly hurt by Ramirez. I looked at my watch. It was almost 9. I couldn't get to Bernie before closing. Too bad. I was pretty sure if I had a daiquiri, I could think much more clearly and probably figure out who tried to send me into orbit. I turned the television on and sat in front of it, but my mind was elsewhere. It was scanning for potential assassins. Of my captures, only Lonnie Dodd was a possibility, and he was in jail. More likely this had to do with the Kulesa murder. Someone was worried about me poking around. I couldn't imagine anyone being worried enough to want to kill me. Death was very serious shit. There had to be something I was missing here. Something about Carmen, or Kulesa, or Morelli. Or maybe the mystery witness. An ugly little thought wriggled around in a back corner of my brain. So far as I could see, I was a genuine, mortal threat to only one person. That person was Morelli. The phone rang at 11, and I caught it before the machine picked up. "Are you alone?" Morelli asked. I hesitated. "Yes." "Why the hesitation?" "How do you feel on the subject of murder?" "Whose murder are we talking about?" "Mine." "I feel warm all over." "Just wondering." "I'm coming up. Watch for me at the door." I tucked the defense spray into the waistband of my shorts and covered it with my T-shirt. I glued my eye to the peephole and opened the door when Morelli strolled down the hall. Every day, he looked a little bit worse. He needed a haircut, and he had a week's worth of beard that probably had only taken him 2 days to grow. His jeans and T-shirt were street person quality. He closed and locked the door behind himself. He took in my scorched, bruised face and the bruises on my arm. His expression was grim.
You want to tell me about it?
The cut lip and the bruises are from Ramirez. We had a tussle, but I think I won. I gassed him and left him throwing up in the road.
And the singed eyebrows?
Well, that's a little complicated. His face darkened.
What happened?
Your car blew up. There was no reaction for several beats.
You want to run that by me again?
He finally said.
The good news is, you don't have to worry about Morty Byers anymore.
And the bad news? I took his license plate from the kitchen counter and handed it to him.
This is all that's left of your car.
He stared down at the plate in shocked silence. I told him about Morty Byers' wife leaving him, and the bomb, and the 3 phone calls from Dorsey. He drew the same conclusion I'd drawn.
It wasn't Ramirez.
I made a mental list of people who might want me dead, and your name was at the top.
Only in my dreams, he said. Who else was on the list?
Lonnie Dodd. But I think he's still in prison.
You ever get death threats? How about ex-husbands or ex-boyfriends? You run over anyone recently?
I had no intention of dignifying that question with a reaction.
Okay, he said. So you think this is associated with the Kulesa murder?
Yes.
Are you scared?
Yes.
Good. Then you'll be careful.
He opened my refrigerator door, pulled out the leftovers my mom had sent home with me, and ate them cold.
You need to be careful when you talk to Dorsey. If he finds out you've been working with me, he could charge you with aiding and abetting.
I have this very disturbing suspicion that I've been talked into an alliance that's not in my best interest. He cracked a beer open. The only way you're going to collect that $10,000 is if I allow you to bring me in. And I'm not going to allow you to bring me in if I can't prove myself innocent. Anytime you want to call the deal off, just let me know. But you can kiss your money goodbye.
That's a rotten attitude.
He shook his head.
Realistic.
I could have gassed you any number of times.
I don't think so.
I whipped the spray out. But before I could aim, he'd knocked the canister from my hand and sent it flying across the room.
Doesn't count, I said. You were expecting it.
He finished his sandwich and slid his dish into the dishwasher.
I'm always expecting it.
Where do we go from here?
We keep doing more of the same. Obviously, we're hitting a nerve.
I don't like being a target.
You aren't going to whine about this, are you?
He settled himself in front of the television and started working the channel changer. He looked tired, sitting with his back against the wall, one leg bent at the knee. He locked in a late-night show and closed his eyes. His breathing grew deep and even, and his head slumped to his chest.
I could gas you now, I whispered.
He raised his head, but he didn't open his eyes. A smile played at the corners of his mouth.
It's not your style, Cupcake.
He was still sleeping on the floor in front of the television when I got up at 8. I tiptoed past him and went out to run. He was reading the paper and drinking coffee when I returned.
Anything in there about the bombing?
I asked. Story and pictures on page 3. They're calling it an unexplained explosion. Nothing especially interesting. He looked over the top of the paper at me. Dorsey left another message on your machine. Maybe you should see what he wants.
I took a fast shower, dressed in clean clothes, slathered some aloe cream on my blistered face, and followed my scaly nose to the coffee pot. I drank half a cup while I read the funnies, and then I called Dorsey.
"We've got the analysis back from the lab," he said. "It was definitely a bomb. Professional job. Of course, you can get a book out of any library will tell you how to do a professional bombing. You could build a fucking nuke if you wanted to. Anyway, I thought you'd want to know."
I suspected as much. "You have any ideas who would do such a thing?"
"No names." "How about Morelli?"
"That's a possibility."
"I missed you at the station yesterday."
He was fishing. He knew there was something screwy about all of this. He just hadn't figured it out yet. "Welcome to the club, Dorsey."
"I'll try to get there today." "Try real hard."
I hung up and topped off my coffee. "Dorsey wants me to come in."
"Are you going?"
"No. He's going to ask questions I can't answer."
"You should put in some time on Stark Street this morning."
"Not this morning. I have things to do."
"What things?"
"Personal things." He raised an eyebrow. "I have some loose ends to tie up, just in case," I said.
"Just in case what?"
I made an exasperated gesture. "Just in case something happens to me. For the past 10 days, I've been stalked by a professional sadist, and now I'm on the Happy Bombers hit list. I feel a little insecure, okay? Give me a break, Morelli. I need to see some people. I have a few personal errands to run." He gently peeled a strip of loose skin off my nose.
"You're gonna be okay," he said softly. "I understand that you're scared. I get scared, too. But we're the good guys, and the good guys always win."
I really felt like a jerk, because here was Morelli being nice to me, and what I actually wanted to do was hop on over to Bernie's and buy a blender and get my free daiquiri mix.
"How were you planning on running these errands without the Jeep?" he asked.
"I retrieved the Nova." He winced.
"You didn't park it in the lot, did you?"
"I was hoping the bomber wouldn't know it was my car."
"Oh, boy."
"I'm sure I have nothing to worry about," I said.
"Yeah, I'm sure, too. I'll go down with you just to make double sure."
I collected my gear, checked the windows, and reset the answering machine. Morelli was waiting for me at the door. We walked downstairs together, and we both paused when we reached the Nova.
"Even if the bomber knew this was your car, he'd have to be stupid to try the same thing twice," Morelli said. "Statistically, the second hit comes from a different direction."
Made perfect sense to me, but my feet were stuck to the pavement and my heart was rocketing around in my chest. "All right. Here I go," I said. "Now or never." Morelli had dropped to his belly and was looking under the Nova.
"What do you see?"
I asked him.
"A hell of an oil leak."
He crawled out and got to his feet. I raised the hood and checked the dipstick. Wonder of wonders, the car needed oil. I fed it 2 cans and slammed the hood down. Morelli had taken the keys from the door handle and angled himself behind the wheel.
"Stand back," he said to me.
"No way. This is my car. I'll start it up."
If one of us is going to get blown apart, it might as well be me. I'm as good as dead if I don't find that missing witness anyway. Move away from the car.
He turned the key. Nothing happened. He looked at me.
Sometimes you have to smack it around, I said.
He turned the key again and brought his fist down hard on the dash. The car coughed and caught. It idled rough and then settled in.
Morelli slumped against the wheel, eyes closed.
Shit.
I looked in the window at him. Is my seat wet?
Very funny.
He got out of the car and held the door for me.
Do you want me to follow?
No, I'll be fine.
Thanks.
I'll be on Stark Street if you need me.
Who knows? Maybe the witness will show up at the gym.
When I got to Bernie's store, I noticed people weren't standing in line to go through the door, so I assumed I was in good shape for the daiquiri mix.
Hey, Bernie said. Look who's here.
I got your message about the blender.
It's this little baby, he said, patting a display blender. It chops nuts, crushes ice, mashes bananas, and makes a hell of a daiquiri.
I looked at the price affixed to the blender. I could afford it.
Sold. Do I get my free daiquiri mix?
You bet. He took a box blender to the register, bagged it, and rang it up.
How's it going?
He asked cautiously, his eyes fixed on the singed stumps of hair that had once been eyebrows.
It's been better.
A daiquiri will help.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
On the other side of the street, Sal was Windexing his front door. He was a pleasant-looking man, thick-bodied and balding, wrapped in his white butcher's apron. So far as I knew, he was a small-time bookie. Nothing special. I doubted he was connected. So why would a guy like Kulesa, whose entire life centered on Stark Street, drive all the way across town to see Sal? I knew a few of Kulesa's vital statistics, but I didn't know anything of his personal life. Shopping at Sal's was the only moderately interesting piece of information I had about Kulesa. Maybe Ziggy was a betting man. Maybe he and Sal were old friends. Maybe they were related. Now that I thought about it, maybe Sal would know about Carmen or the guy with the flat nose. I chatted with Bernie for a few more minutes while I settled into the idea of interviewing Sal. I watched a woman enter the shop and make a purchase. This seemed like a good approach to me. It would give me an opportunity to look around. I promised Bernie I'd be back for bigger and better appliances and walked across the street to Sal's. Chapter 13. I pushed through Sal's front door and went to the long case filled with steaks and ground meat patties and twine-bound roasts. Sal gave me a welcoming smile.
What can I do for you?
I was at Kuntz's buying a blender. I held the bag up for him to see. And I thought I'd get something for supper while I was here.
Sausage? Fresh fish? Nice piece of chicken?
Fish.
I got some flounder just caught off the Jersey Shore.
Probably it glowed in the dark. That'll be fine. Enough for two people. Somewhere in the back a door opened, and I could hear the drone of a truck motor. The door clanged shut, and the motor noise disappeared. A man entered from the hallway beside the walk-in, and my heart jumped into triple time. Not only was the man's nose smashed, but his entire face looked as if it had been pressed flat, as if it had been hit with a frying pan. I couldn't know for sure until Morelli took a look, but I suspected I'd found the missing witness. I was torn between wanting to jump up and down and make sounds of excitement and wanting to bolt and run before I was hacked up into chops and roasts.
"Got a delivery for you," the man said to Sal. "You want it in the lockup?"
"Yeah," Sal said. "And take the two barrels set by the door. One of them's heavy. You'll need the dolly."
Sal's attention turned back to the fish.
"How you gonna cook these fillets?"
he asked me.
"You know you can pan fry them, or bake them, or stuff them. Personally, I like them fried. Heavy batter, deep fat."
I heard the back door close after the guy with the flat face.
"Who was that?" I asked.
"Lewis. Works for the distributor in Philly. He brings up meat."
"And then what does he take back in the barrels?"
"Sometimes I save up trim. They use it for dog food."
I had to grit my teeth to keep from flying out the door. I'd found the witness. I was sure of it. By the time I got to the Nova, I was dizzy with the effort of restraint. I was saved! I was going to be able to pay my rent. I'd succeeded at something. And now that the missing witness was found, I'd be safe. I'd turn Morelli in and have nothing more to do with Ziggy Kalesa. I'd be out of the picture. There'd be no reason for anyone to want to kill me. Except, of course, Ramirez. And hopefully, Ramirez would be implicated sufficiently to put him away for a long, long time. The old man across from Carmen's apartment had said he'd been bothered by the noise from a refrigerator truck. Dollars to donuts, it had been a meat truck. I couldn't know for sure until I did another check on the back of Carmen's apartment building. But if Lewis had parked close enough, he might have been able to ease himself down onto the roof of the refrigerator truck. Then he put Carmen on ice and drove away. I couldn't figure the connection with Sal. Maybe there was no connection. Maybe it was just Ziggy and Lewis working as cleanup for Ramirez. I had a decent view of Sal's from where I sat. I shoved the key into the ignition and took one last look. Sal and Lewis were talking. Lewis was cool. Sal was agitated, throwing his hands into the air. I decided to watch a while. Sal turned his back on Lewis and made a phone call. Even from this distance, I could see he wasn't happy. He slammed the receiver down, and both men went into the walk-in freezer and reappeared moments later, rolling out the trim drum. They shunted the drum down the hallway leading to the back exit. Lewis reappeared a short while later with what appeared to be a side of beef slung over his shoulder. He deposited the meat in the freezer and rolled out the second drum. He paused at the back hallway and started toward the front of the store. My heart skipped in my chest, and I wondered if he could see me snooping. He walked forward, and I reached for my SureGuard. He stopped at the door and turned the little open sign to closed. I hadn't expected this. What did this mean? Sal was nowhere in sight. The store was closed, and so far as I knew, it wasn't a holiday. Lewis left through the back hallway, and the lights went out. I got a bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. The bad feeling escalated to panic, and the panic told me not to lose Lewis. I put the Nova in gear and drove to the end of the block. A white refrigerator truck with Pennsylvania plates eased into traffic ahead of me, and two blocks later, we turned onto Chambers. I would have liked nothing better than to drop the whole thing in Morelli's lap, but I hadn't a clue how to get in touch with him. He was north of me on Stark Street, and I was heading south.
He probably had a phone in the van, but I didn't know the number. And besides, I couldn't call him until we stopped somewhere. The refrigerator truck picked up Route 206 at Whitehorse. Traffic was moderately heavy. I was 2 car lengths back, and I found it fairly easy to stay hidden and at the same time keep sight of Lewis. Just past the junction of Route 70, my oil light went on and stayed on. I did some vigorous swearing, screeched to a stop on the shoulder, poured 2 cans of oil with breakneck precision, slammed the hood, and took off. I pushed the Nova up to 80, ignoring the shimmy in the front end and the startled looks of other drivers as I rattled past them in my pussymobile. After an agonizing couple of miles, I caught sight of the truck. Lewis was one of the slower drivers on the road, holding his speed down to only 10 miles an hour over the limit. I breathed a sigh of relief and fell into place. I prayed he wasn't going far. I only had 1.5 cases of oil in the back seat. At Hammonton, Lewis left-turned onto a secondary road and drove east. There were fewer cars on this road, and I had to drop farther back. The countryside was rolling farmland and patches of woods. After about 15 miles, the truck slowed and pulled into a gravel drive that led to a corrugated metal warehouse-type building. The sign on the front of the building said that this was Pachetco Inlet Marina and Cold Storage. Beyond the building, I could see boats, and beyond the boats, the glare of sun on open water. I sailed by the lot and made a U-turn 1/4 mile up the road where it dead-ended at the Mullico River. I returned and did a slow drive-by. The truck was parked at the board walkway that led to the boat slips. Lewis and Sal were out of the truck, leaning against the back step bumper, looking like they were waiting for something or someone. They were alone in the lot. It was a small marina, and it seemed that even though it was summer, most of the activity was still weekend-based. I'd passed a gas station 1 mile back. I decided it would be an inconspicuous place to wait. If Sal or Lewis left the marina, they'd go in this direction, back to civilization, and I could follow. There was the added advantage of a public phone and the possibility of getting in touch with Morelli. The station was pre-computer age, with 2 old-fashioned gas pumps on a stained cement pad. A sign, propped on one of the pumps, advertised live bait and cheap gas. The single-level shack behind the pumps was brown shingle patched with flattened jerry cans and assorted pieces of plywood. A public phone had been installed next to the screen door. I parked, partially hidden, behind the station, and walked the short distance to the phone, happy for the opportunity to stretch my legs. I called my own number. It was the only thing I could think to do. The phone rang once, the machine answered, and I listened to my own voice tell me I wasn't home. "Anybody there?" I asked. No reply. I gave the public phone number and suggested if anyone needed to get in touch with me, I'd be at that number for an indeterminate number of minutes. I was about to get back into my car when Ramirez's Porsche sped by. This is curiouser and curiouser, I thought. Here we have a butcher, a shooter, and a boxer, meeting at the Pachetco Inlet Marina. It seemed unlikely that they were just 3 guys going fishing. If it had been anyone other than Ramirez who had driven down the road, I might have ventured closer to take a peek. I told myself I was holding back because Ramirez might recognize the Nova. This was only part of the truth. Ramirez had succeeded in his goal. The mere sight of his car sent me into a cold sweat of terror that left serious doubts about my ability to function through another confrontation. A short time later, the Porsche hummed past me, en route to the highway. The windows were tinted, obscuring vision, but at best it could seat only two men. So that left at least one man at the marina. Hopefully, that one man was Lewis. I made another call to my answering machine. This message was more urgent. "Call me," I said. It was close to dark before the phone finally rang.
"Where are you?" Morelli asked.
"I'm at the shore, at a gas station on the outskirts of Atlantic City. I found the witness. His name is Lewis."
"Is he with you?"
"He's down the road." I briefed Morelli on the day's events and gave him directions to the marina. I bought a soda from an outside machine and went back to do more waiting. It was deep twilight when Morelli finally pulled up next to me in the van. There had been no traffic on the road since Ramirez, and I was sure the truck hadn't slipped by. It had occurred to me that Lewis might be on a boat, possibly spending the night. I couldn't see any other reason for the truck to still be in the marina lot.
"Is our man at the marina?" Morelli asked.
"So far as I know."
"Has Ramirez come back?"
I shook my head no.
"Think I'll take a look around. You wait here."
No way was I doing any more waiting anywhere. I was fed up with waiting, and I didn't entirely trust Morelli. He had an annoying habit of making beguiling promises and then waltzing out of my life. I followed the van to the water's edge and parked beside it. The white refrigerator truck hadn't been moved. Lewis wasn't out and about. The boats tied up to the wharf were dark. The Pacheco Inlet Marina was not exactly a bustling hub of activity. I got out of the Nova and walked around to Morelli.
"I thought I told you to wait at the gas station," Morelli said. "We look like a fucking parade."
"I thought you might need help with Lewis." Morelli was out of the van and standing beside me, looking disreputable and dangerous in the dark. He smiled, and his teeth were startlingly white against his black beard.
"Liar. You're worried about your 10,000.
"That too." We stared at each other for a while, making silent assessments. Morelli finally reached through the open window, snatched a jacket off the front seat, pulled a semi-automatic from the jacket pocket, and shoved it into the waistband of his jeans.
"I suppose we might as well look for my witness."
We walked to the truck and peered inside the cab. The cab was empty and locked. No other cars were parked in the lot. Nearby, water lapped at pilings, and boats groaned against their moorings. There were four board docks with 14 slips each, 7 to a side. Not all of the slips were in use. We quietly walked the length of each dock, reading boat names, looking for signs of habitation. Halfway down the third dock, we stopped at a big Hatteras convertible with a flying bridge, and we both mouthed the boat's name. Sal's Gal. Morelli boarded and crept aft. I followed several feet behind. The deck was littered with fishing gear, long-handled nets and gaffs. The door to the salon was padlocked on the outside, telling us Lewis was probably not on the inside. Morelli pulled a penlight from his pocket and shone it into the cabin window. The largest portion of the boat interior appeared to have been stripped down for serious fishing, similar to a headboat,
with utilitarian benches in place of more luxurious accommodations. The small galley was cluttered with crushed beer cans and stacks of soiled paper plates. The residue from some sort of powder spill glittered under the penlight.
"Sal's a slob," I said.
"You sure Lewis wasn't in the car with Ramirez?"
Morelli asked.
"I have no way of knowing. The car has tinted glass, but it only seats two, so at least one person is left here."
"And there were no other cars on the road?"
"No."
"He could have gone in the other direction," Morelli said.
"He wouldn't have gone far. It dead ends in a quarter mile."
The moon was low in the sky, spilling silver dollars of light onto the water. We looked back at the white refrigerator truck. The cooler motor hummed quietly in the darkness.
"Maybe we should take another look at the truck," Morelli said.
His tone gave me an uneasy feeling, and I didn't want to voice the question that had popped into my head. We'd already determined Lewis wasn't in the cab. What was left? We returned to the truck, and Morelli scanned the outside thermostat controls for the refrigeration unit.
"What's it set at?" I asked.
20.
"Why so cold?" Morelli stepped down and moved to the back door.
"Why do you think?"
"Somebody's trying to freeze something?"
"That would be my guess, too."
The back door to the truck was held closed by a heavy-duty bolt and padlock. Morelli weighed the padlock in the palm of his hand.
"Could be worse," he said.
He jogged to the van and returned with a small hacksaw. I nervously looked around the lot. I didn't especially want to get caught hijacking a meat truck.
"Isn't there a better way to do this?" I stage whispered over the rasp of the saw. "Can't you just pick the lock?"
"This is faster," Morelli said.
"Just keep your eyes peeled for a night watchman."
The saw blade lunged through the metal, and the lock swung open. Morelli threw the bolt back and pulled on the thick insulated door. The interior of the truck was Stygian black. Morelli hauled himself up onto the single-step bumper, and I scrambled after him, wrestling my flashlight out of my shoulder bag. The frigid air pressed against me and took my breath away. We both trained our lights on the frost-shrouded walls. Huge, empty meat hooks hung from the ceiling. Nearest the door was the large trim barrel I'd seen them roll out earlier in the afternoon. The empty barrel stood nearby, its lid slanted between the barrel and the truck wall. I slid my spot of light farther to the rear and dropped it lower. My eyes focused, and I sucked in cold air when I realized what I was seeing. Lewis was sprawled, spread-eagle on his back, his eyes impossibly wide and unblinking, his feet splayed. Snot had run out of his nose and frozen to his cheek. A large urine stain had crystallized on the front of his work pants. He had a large dark dot in the middle of his forehead. Sal lay next to him, with an identical dot, and the same dumbstruck expression on his frozen face.
"Shit," Morelli said. "I'm not having any luck at all."
The only dead people I'd ever seen had been embalmed and dressed up for church. Their hair had been styled, their cheeks had been rouged, and their eyes had been closed to suggest eternal slumber. None of them had been shot in the forehead. I felt bile rise in my throat and clapped a hand over my mouth. Morelli yanked me out the door and onto the gravel.
"Don't throw up in the truck," he said. "You'll screw up the crime scene."
I did some deep breathing and willed my stomach to settle. Morelli had his hand on the back of my neck.
"You gonna be okay?"
I nodded violently.
I'm fine. Just took me by surprise.
I need some stuff from the van. Stay here. Don't go back in the truck and don't touch anything.
He didn't have to worry about me going back into the truck. Wild horses couldn't drag me back into the truck. He returned with a crowbar and two pairs of disposable gloves. He gave one pair to me. We snapped the gloves on, and Morelli climbed up the step bumper.
"Shine the light on Lewis," he ordered, bending over the body.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm looking for the missing gun."
He stood and tossed a set of keys at me.
No gun on him, but he had these keys in his pocket. See if one of them opens the cab door.
I opened the passenger side door and searched the map pockets, the glove compartment, and under the seat. But I didn't come up with a gun. When I went back to Morelli, he was working at the sealed drum with a crowbar.
"No gun up front," I said.
The lid popped off, and Morelli flicked his flashlight on and looked inside.
"Well?" I asked.
His voice was tight when he answered.
"It's Carmen."
I was hit with another wave of nausea.
"You think Carmen's been in Sal's freezer all this time?"
"Looks like it."
"Why would he keep her around? Wouldn't he be afraid someone would discover her?" Morelli shrugged.
"I suppose he felt safe. Maybe he's done this sort of thing before. You do something often enough, and you become complacent."
"You're thinking about those other women who've disappeared from Stark Street."
"Yeah. Sal was probably just waiting for a convenient time to take Carmen out and dump her at sea."
"I don't understand Sal's connection." Morelli hammered the lid back on.
"Me either. But I feel pretty confident Ramirez can be persuaded to explain it to us."
He wiped his hands on his pants and left smudges of white.
"What's with all this white stuff?" I asked.
"Sal got a thing with baby powder or cleanser or something?"
Morelli looked down at his hands and his pants.
"I hadn't noticed."
"There was powder on the floor of the boat, and now you picked some up from the drum and wiped it on your pants."
"Jesus," Morelli said, staring at his hand. "Holy shit."
He flipped the lid off the drum and ran his finger around the inside rim. He put the finger to his mouth and tasted it.
"This is dope."
"Sal doesn't strike me as a crackhead."
"It's not crack. It's heroin."
"Are you sure?"
"I've seen a lot of it."
I could see him smiling in the dark.
"Sweet Pea, I think we've just found ourselves a drop boat," he said. "All along I've been thinking this was about protecting Ramirez, but now I'm not so sure. I think this might be about drugs."
"What's a drop boat?"
"It's a small boat that goes out to sea to rendezvous with a larger ship engaged in drug smuggling. Most of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Burma. It's usually routed through northern Africa, then up to Amsterdam or some other European city. In the past, the favored method of entry for the Northeast has been to body pack it through Kennedy. For a year now, we've been getting tips that the stuff is traveling big time on ships coming into Port Newark. The DEA and Customs have been working overtime and coming up empty."
He held his finger in the air for inspection.
"I think this could be the reason. By the time the ship sails into Newark, the heroin's already been offloaded."
"Onto a drop boat," I said.
"Yeah. The drop boat snags the dope from the mothership and brings it back to a small marina like this where there are no customs inspectors." My guess is they load the stuff into these barrels after it's handed down, and one of the bags broke last time out.
Hard to believe someone would be that sloppy about leaving incriminating evidence.
Morelli grunted. You work with drugs all the time, and they become commonplace. You wouldn't believe what people leave in full view in apartments and garages. Besides, the boat belongs to Sal, and chances are Sal wasn't along for the ride. That way, if the boat gets busted, Sal says he loaned it to a friend. He didn't know it was being used for illegal activities.
You think this is why there's so much heroin in Trenton?
Could be. When you have a drop boat like this, you can bring in large quantities and eliminate the couriers, so you have good availability and low overhead. The cost on the street goes down, and the purity goes up. And addicts start dying.
Yeah.
Why do you think Ramirez shot Sal and Lewis?
Maybe Ramirez had to burn some bridges.
Morelli played his light over the back corners of the truck. I could barely see him in the dark, but I could hear the scrape of his feet as he moved.
What are you doing? I asked.
I'm looking for a gun. In case you haven't noticed, I'm shit out of luck. My witness is dead.
If I can't find Ziggy's missing gun with an intact latent, I'm as good as dead, too.
There's always Ramirez,
who may or may not be feeling talkative.
I think you're overreacting. I can place Ramirez at the scene of 2 execution-type killings, and we've uncovered a major drug operation.
Possibly this casts some doubt about Ziggy's character, but it doesn't alter the fact that I appeared to have shot an unarmed man.
Ranger says you've got to trust in the system.
Ranger ignores the system.
I didn't want to see Morelli in jail for a crime he didn't commit. But I also didn't want him living the life of a fugitive. He was actually a pretty good guy, and as much as I hated to admit it, I'd become fond of him. When the manhunt was over, I'd miss the teasing and the late-night companionship. It was true that Morelli still touched a nerve every now and then, but there was a new feeling of partnership that transcended most of my earlier anger. I found it hard to believe he would be sent to jail in light of all the new evidence. Possibly he would lose his job on the force. This seemed like a minor disgrace to me when compared to spending long years in hiding.
I think we should call the police and let them sort through this, I said to Morelli.
You can't stay in hiding for the rest of your life. What about your mother? What about your phone bill?
My phone bill? Oh, shit, Stephanie, you haven't been running up my phone bill, have you?
We had an agreement. You were going to let me bring you in when we found the missing witness.
I hadn't counted on him being dead.
I'll be evicted.
Listen, Stephanie, your apartment isn't all that great. Besides, this is wasted talk. We both know you aren't capable of bringing me in by force. The only way you're going to collect your money is by my permission. You're just gonna have to sit tight.
I don't like your attitude, Morelli. The light whirled, and he lunged toward the door.
I don't much care what you think of my attitude. I'm not in a good mood. My witness is dead, and I can't find the damn murder weapon. Probably Ramirez will squeal like a pig, and I'll be exonerated, but until that happens, I'm staying hidden.
The hell you are! I can't believe it's in your best interest. Suppose some cop sees you and shoots you. Besides, I have a job to do, and I'm going to do it. I should never have made this deal with you.
It was a good deal, he said.
Would you have made it?
No, but I'm not you. I have skills you could only dream about, and I'm a hell of a lot meaner than you'll ever be.
You underestimate me. I'm pretty fucking mean. Morelli grinned.
You're a marshmallow. soft and sweet, and when you get heated up, you go all gooey and delicious. I was rendered speechless. I couldn't believe just seconds before I'd been thinking friendly, protective thoughts about this oaf.